ladies and gentlemen, everybody, for coming here on a cold Sydney Monday afternoon after an even colder weekend. I'm here to introduce our guest speaker for today, a very noted expert in the security studies field from Georgetown University, and an expert in South Asian politics in particular. Christine Fair is a Provost Distinguished Associate Professor in Security Studies within the Edmund A. Walsh School of Foreign Service at Georgetown University. She was previously a senior political scientist with the RAND Corporation, a political officer with the UN Assistance Mission to Afghanistan, and a senior research associate with the US Institute of Peace. She has a PhD from the Department of South Asian Languages and Civilization from the University of Chicago. She's the author of several books, and as you said, an expert in counterterrorism in South Asia. And today, for about 20 minutes, followed by a bit of a discussion with myself for about 15 minutes, and then we'll open up to the floor for Q&A. We're going to look at the subject of the future security challenges for Afghanistan. And I'm sure all of you will agree that there are many and varied of those, and Christine will do a fantastic job in keeping yourself to 20 minutes in trying to explain a few of those. But I'd ask you all to please warmly welcome Christine.
So thank you all for coming out here. I have to say your weather is brilliant, because I've spent most of the summer in India, in Myanmar, where I've sweated my tail off. And then very briefly, like 24 hours, in my home state of Virginia, where I also sweated my tail off. So this is actually quite pleasant for me. So thank you all again. And there's a bunch of people to thank who've actually brought me from the United States to Australia. And I'm very grateful to them as well. All right, so I know some of you, because I recognize some of my colleagues from UNAMA. But it's hard in a forum like this to figure out where do you start, because you have this unevenness. You have people who know an awful lot about Afghanistan, and then then there are others who are somewhat new, and then trying to pitch it so that you're not under or over talking is kind of a challenge. But let me sort of tell you where, having been a South Asianist and having watched the DC sausage maker begin when 9/11 happened. The seeds of defeat, and I want to be very clear, it is defeat. It was defeat purchased on the installment plan, were pretty clear by the time December 2001 came around. And let me sort of explain why that is. We have a very long history of dealing with Pakistan. And that history, and I'm going to start the story with Pakistan, because I believe, in the way I have sort of understood the problem set, that Pakistan has from the beginning been the biggest problem. So when we went into this war with Afghanistan, we had a fairly significant problem that was very clear by virtue of the map, right? You need to have a port to get yourself into theater and to sustain yourself. And if you looked at where Afghanistan was situated and what your options were pretty thin. You had Pakistan, right, which is adjacent, and it has at least one significant commercial port. You have Iran, which is a very bizarre creature in American politics for a lot of reasons, much of which can be reduced to Israel, and also this neuralgic obsession with the hostage crisis that followed the Shah's ouster and the arrival of the religious regime in Iran. And from the Iranian point of view, their issue is, of course, the American overturning of the Mossadegh government, right? So we've got on both sides of these very complicated historical reasons to be wary of each other. And on the U.S. side, and also on the Iranian side, we have this huge complicating factor of Israel. So there is a port in Iran, but Americans were certainly not going to avail of it. And I'm going to put an asterisk there, because this is a really interesting footnote in history. Khatami, if you'll recall, opened up in a very significant way to the Americans. And for those who were present at Bonn, which was the mechanism that we built the post-Taliban regime, it was actually the Iranians that were adamant that the Afghan constitution mentioned democracy. Actually, Khatami was incredibly supportive of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan. But what he got in return, of course, was George W. Bush clubbing Iran as a founding member of the Axis of Evil, right? So Iran, for a variety of reasons, which, by the way, I did write a cookbook called The Cuisines of the Axis of Evil, another irritating state, so I had fun with that. But then the other possibility would be what would eventually be called the Northern Distribution Route. And the problem with the Northern Distribution Route is that it's a really long way to a port, right? And once you got to a port, you would have to have these bilateral agreements with a variety of other Central Asian states before you could even get close to the Afghan border. And so for a bunch of reasons, the Americans decided that they were going to go to war in Afghanistan with that one country, Pakistan, that was actually committed to us failing in every possible way. Right, so this is a little bit like setting up a daycare and putting a pederast in charge of it. Yeah, I guess you guys don't like pederast jokes here. But I say that in complete seriousness, right? Because if you look at Afghanistan from Pakistan's point of view, the Taliban were and are Pakistan's best bet of managing its security interests in the region. And the partner that we eventually went to war with, the Northern Alliance, was viewed from Pakistan's point of view as an Indian proxy. And that view, by the way, was not ill-informed. So if you're going to fight a war in a country like Afghanistan, and your primary partner is also the one country that is dedicated to you failing, what are your options? Right? If you know that this is going to be the outcome, maybe you shouldn't have fought that war in the first place, right? But we are where we are, and we have fought this war in a way that has deferred defeat, but we are now in a different time, right? We now have President Trump. So the question isn't how or whether we are going to get rid of this commitment to Afghanistan. It's with what egregious and outrageous consequences are we, the Americans, going to disencumber ourselves from this Afghanistan problem. So back in January 2008, I actually thought something remarkable happened, that someone maybe explained the way the world worked to Donald Trump, because in January 2018, he began tweeting things that were actually true, which is surprising, because he's actually told well over 11,000 documented lies since becoming the POTUS. I couldn't understand what actually happened to Donald Trump. He began saying the Pakistanis are liars, they're undermining our effort in Afghanistan, they're killing our soldiers, our civilians, and our allies. And I was like, holy crap, the dude actually figured some stuff out over the weekend. But I knew that this wasn't going to be long-lived because of this map problem, right? And whereas President Obama had put into place the what we'll basically call the U.S.-Iran nuclear deal, he was dedicated to undoing it, right? So when Obama left office, we had this rapprochement. We had an international community that was interested in bringing Iran into the international community. And the Indians had actually been developing a port in Chabahar. And that port could be a really important alternative supply route, not only for other actors interested in being present in Afghanistan, but most importantly for Afghanistan itself to exert economic independence from this predatory neighbor, right? So someone must have then pointed out to President Trump after his tweet storm, sir, we have a problem. Because that whole Iran thing that you just did, we actually are still very much dependent upon Pakistan. And so you did see for a while the deep state trying to execute the orders of the tweet state, right? We did find a way of, you know, cutting off money. We did find a way of being mean to Pakistan for a while. But very quickly, when President Trump realized that his own surge under General Nicholson was not working any more than any other previous surge, which was actually bigger. And by the way, I would argue, as I have, the reason why none of those surges worked was because we never had a coercive policy towards Pakistan, right? You can't, again, go to war with your partner, and your partner being the one country who wants to do everything it can to ensure that you fail, right? So Trump wants out. So Trump is fetishistically dedicated to checking off his election or his campaign promises. It doesn't matter how ill-advised or ill-informed they were or how injurious they are to U.S. interests or those of our partners. He wants to get out of Afghanistan, right? And he's not going to get out of Afghanistan on terms that he had initially hoped, which was the surge, knock a couple of heads around, the Taliban are come to the negotiating table. It didn't work for the same reason that none of the other surges happened. So he does something that's quite interesting. He brings Zalmay Khalilzad. And if you know anything about Zalmay Khalilzad, it really is extraordinary because Zalmay Khalilzad is even more critical of Pakistan than I am. And that's pretty critical. And I don't know what he promised Zalmay Khalilzad. He's also, he was part of the neocons. He's an Afghan American. He was very close to George W. So he somehow got Zalmay Khalilzad to come on board to become essentially this special representative for Afghanistan and Pakistan, but his primary remit was bring the Taliban to the table. And this required Khalilzad to do something he probably didn't want to do, which was actually treat Pakistanis with dignity. Because it's the Pakistanis who, more than anyone, can bring these Taliban to the table. Now, but we can debate, do the Pakistanis exhibit positive control? Do they exhibit negative control? That is to say, can they make them do things that they want to do or punish them for doing things that they don't want them to do? We can debate this. But what we cannot debate is that the Pakistanis provide every possible means of support to the Taliban, whether it's financial, military. In fact, your own soldiers that have fought in Afghanistan will tell you, as mine will, that we've even seen Pakistan's elite special operators, the special services group, co-located with Taliban and fighting them, right? So if it weren't for the Pakistanis, we wouldn't even care about the Taliban, frankly speaking. So what you've seen over the course of this past year, as President Trump is increasingly desperate to get out of Afghanistan, you've seen Zalmay Khalilzad accept increasingly preposterous preconditions from the Taliban, who, while, by the way, are negotiating peace with the Americans, are still engaging in outrageous acts of violence, such as slaughtering children in schools, right? So what are the Taliban demands? And I'm keeping an eye on the time. So the Taliban's demands are fairly straightforward. They want to be back in governance without contesting elections. They actually want elections to be gone altogether because they think they're un-Islamic. And they're particularly interested in rolling back the rights of women and girls. And I've been in a variety of fora, and I've seen American officials say, we're going to find a way to make this happen. So I am highly skeptical that the Afghan elections for the presidency are going to happen. They've already been postponed a number of times. The Americans are very keen to find a way to accommodate these Taliban demands, and they've done everything they can to keep outside of the negotiating parameters the legitimately asterisk Afghan government. I say asterisk because anyone who's been an election observer in Afghanistan knows these elections range from like horrifically corrupt to industrial strength corruption in terms of the freeness and fairness of the elections. So what does this mean? What this means is that we are definitely getting out of Afghanistan because Trump views this as something he has to do to be reelected. And to understand a little bit of how Trump sees things, this is also true of his outrageous domestic policies like his tariffs. From his point of view, he'll either not get reelected, in which case his problematic policies become someone else's problems, or he does get reelected, and it still isn't his problem because he can only legally serve 2 terms, right? So he is just truly uninterested in the long term, which is quite unusual from any other Democratic or Republican president we've ever had. They've always been concerned about their legacy, right? Not the sheer audacity of what they can do in any given moment, right? So Trump is much more interested in acquiring power. He's much more interested in adding as he serves to his own personal and family wealth than he is thinking about any legacy. In some sense, his legacy is really undermining Obama's legacy. So what does this mean for Afghanistan? So in fora like this, we often talk about how many troops should we have, what should the troops do. What I've seen, and I think Leanne Smith is here in the audience, she'll probably attest to this, we have never had a discussion about other aspects of Afghanistan's future, namely its economic viability. You try to have this conversation and eyes gloss over. So why is this important? Well, it's important for the reason that having an American soldier is important. As long as there is an American soldier present in Afghanistan, the U.S. Congress can be persuaded to continue writing a check for a government that cannot pay for itself. Right? So under the Soviet Union, Afghanistan was a rentier state. Prior to that, under the British, it was a rentier state. But this is the biggest rentier state that's ever existed in Afghanistan's history, right? It cannot collect enough revenue to pay even part of its recurring costs. So the lesson that we learn from the Soviet Union's withdrawal was that Najibullah, which is the person that the Soviets left as they in place when they withdrew, he hung on to power despite everything that the Pakistanis threw at him for about 3 years, as long as the checks kept coming. What he was able to do with those checks from the Soviet Union was pay off his national security forces who kept him safe and other important patrons to whom he was, his life, quite frankly, was indebted. So the lesson that I learned from this, it isn't like how many soldiers there are or aren't. It's really how does one continue to pay for a state that cannot pay for itself, right? So as soon as that last soldier hops on the plane and goes someplace else, will the American Congress keep writing these checks? And I submit to you, there's a very high probability that that's not going to happen. So what's going to happen? So all of these militias that with the right incentives, those incentives being checks and power, that were basically assembled to create the Afghan National Army as well as the other security forces, will be equally incentivized to dissolve and become these rent-seeking free agents. So what does that mean in real speak? What it means is that there's a very real risk that Afghanistan again becomes a site of massive civil war. But the stakes are much higher than it was in the 1990s, right? Because the international community had made a lot of promises to Afghans, right? That we're especially to women and girls, right? That we're not going to fight to endow you with these freedoms and then let those freedoms be stripped away from you, right? So there's a lot of credibility on the table that's very much at stake, but I assure you, you know, Trump doesn't care about the rights of women and girls unless he can assault them. In fact, he'll probably change our constitution to put that in there, that you have the right to be assaulted by President Trump. So from my point of view, the very reasons why we went into Afghanistan in the first place have a very real likelihood of reemerging, right? And to just sort of end on an even further depressing note, who has the capacity to step in and write the checks when the Americans stop writing those checks, right? There are certainly interested parties. Chinese are very interested. The Chinese aren't going to do it. The Chinese are, in my view, really interesting freeloaders. Like, they were hoping that we would fight the last Marine to make Afghanistan safe for Chinese exploitation. The Chinese have actually been very tepid. The Iranians have an interest, but since they're so completely buried under sanctions and threats of new sanctions, their ability to contribute is quite limited. The Indians also have an interest. In fact, Afghanistan is their largest recipient of aid, second to Bhutan. But in the real scheme of things, India can't pay these recurring costs either, right? So I'm gonna end on that really uplifting note. And we'll do Q&A, a conversation. Okay. And I apologize. I'm not usually so down. It's the jet lag and menopause. It's a terrible combination. Yes, I just said that, gentlemen.
Thanks, Krista.
If men got menopause, they would have sorted this crap out. But instead, we have to have new versions of Cialis every 6 months. Am I right, ladies?
Thanks, Christine. And I don't think you said too much that surprised people who watch Afghanistan from afar. And understanding that perfection and what people wanted to achieve or believe they could be achieved when the West intervened in Afghanistan in 2001 and what we have now are completely different. What do you think is a sustainable, from both an Afghan perspective and a Western perspective, what is a sustainable degree of stability in Afghanistan? Not a perfect degree of stability, not a system that would satisfy the architects of the intervention at the start, but one that would satisfy external powers and Afghans themselves.
So, I mean, I think about this regionally. So the first thing is Iran has to be part of the solution, right? Which is very much at odds with where Trump sees things. If you look at a map, Afghanistan must have an independent economic GLOC, you know, access to ports. And so Chabahar and Munzer Abbas are the most obvious alternatives to Pakistan. So it's very difficult for me to imagine that happening as long as we have the Gruppenführer in the White House. And I suspect the Gruppenführer will win a second tour. So already the ideal is eviscerated by this political reality in the United States. Second, rather than continuing to appease Pakistan, we need to think very differently about containing Pakistan. Now, I don't mean the kinds of sanctions that would cause grievous injury to a population that's already grievously injured by its army, but certainly the kinds of sanctions that would get Pakistan where it hurts. So all we've done thus far is said, no more American aid for you. That's not really a punishment, right? No matter what Pakistan does, it continues to get a gray listing in the FATF, which is this, you know, anti-terrorism financing regime. It has never been declared a state sponsor of terrorism. Ironically, Cuba has been, right? That's kind of weird from my point of view. So I think for us to get to a place where Afghanistan has a fighting chance, we need to be much more open towards Iran. We need to be much more punitive towards Pakistan. There has to be a cost of using proxy elements to murder Afghans, right? Right now, there has been no cost. In fact, what Pakistan has learned is that because it is so important, it can kill and get paid still while killing, right? So we have to really think very differently our relationship to Pakistan. The other actors that are important to this are, of course, Russia, as well as the Central Asian states. So we need to think about creating an economic regime where Afghanistan can get its materials out of the ground. And by the way, it has a lot of resources. But until it can get those resources out of the ground into the market, it can't literally capitalize upon them. So this also requires some degree of stability, right? And that does necessitate having a very different policy towards Pakistan than not. Unfortunately, the Afghans themselves continue to perpetrate mass corruption, right? And this is, I mean, Ghani, I mean, he had an entire think tank about fixing failed states. He knows what needs to be done. But once he became the president, he also realized what he has to do to remain the president, right? So in the ideal world, you want to create an economic environment where Afghanistan can thrive. You have security and this connectivity picture where it can get its resources out of the ground. You want Afghanistan to diminish the corruption. Here's the other thing that probably has to happen. You have to right-size this government, right? There's no reason for this government to exist on this scale. But right-sizing this government is very difficult to do when you're fighting an insurgency. Because what happens when you get rid of a bunch of guys that are now part of the Ministry of Interior where they get to traffic poppy and get paid to do it? They'll just do that, but instead of being paid by the Ministry of Interior, they'll be paid by a warlord, right? So it's the problem, I would say, is that we have been so obsessed on the security end, right, that the economic piece of this has really been a something that we haven't really forced ourselves to think through. And we're coming to this discussion now when the international community is just not interested in Afghanistan anymore, right? We should have built economic viability in from the beginning. So without, you know, being too much of a buzzkill, I don't see how we avoid a major catastrophe in Afghanistan. And I suspect that only when something really terrible comes out of Afghanistan will we see this crystallization of international interests that will once again, you know, drive some interest in resolving some of those issues.
Do you think that issue about prioritizing security over economic development is a little bit of a chicken and egg issue, that foreign investors are not going to invest in Afghanistan unless they have security of operations, security of return? So whether we like it or not, security has to be the primary responsibility, because economic development can only flow from security, not the other way around.
No, so that's true. And there's actually a lot of scholarship, you know, finely grained empirical scholarship attesting to this. But again, this is where we lost opportunities. So Afghanistan is not a uniform thing, right? As Tom Barfield, a friend, mentor, and colleague of mine, says, Afghanistan is like, in many ways, it's like Swiss cheese. Like, there are holes as long as the holes are managed, right? So you could have imagined a world when Bamiyan did not have Poppy and it did not have Taliban, and they were rewarded. In other words, we economically invested in those places that did not have security threats. But we actually did just the opposite. Speaking, you know, as an American, but looking in more generally at the international flows of money, we, as Americans, we put about 90% of our investments in the four provinces that were most insecure, right? And so this is, instead of creating an incentive frontier where you get investment when there's no Poppy and no Taliban, we actually incentivize just the opposite, right? Because if you were a local Afghan, what you saw was there's no benefit for having no Taliban and no Poppy, right? How do you get money to your area? It's actually by being a nuisance, right? So, and this is, look, this happens. You know, I talked to a lot of folks who study counterinsurgency, counterterrorism. States make this mistake time and time again. And the reason why I think states can't learn these lessons is because at the end of the day, what we're actually doing in any particular country is actually driven by our domestic politics, right? So going to your point, you're absolutely right, but we had other options that we chose not to exercise for reasons that at the time probably made a lot of sense with respect to the parliaments and the congresses that were writing the checks, but which over time were really bad decisions.
One of the sticking points, as you pointed out, with President Najibullah held on for so long, as long as the Soviets wrote the checks, but also more importantly, as long as the Soviets provided logistic support and the enabling military support to allow him to hang on, and once that tap was turned off, the end was nigh. One of the key sticking points in the current negotiations are what's the definition of withdrawal for US forces. Obviously, with sunk costs, the US wants to maintain some footprint within Afghanistan for equally obvious reasons. The Taliban and their supporters want no US enabling forces there. The ability for the US to maintain some kind of footprint, military footprint in Afghanistan after whatever withdrawal or peace agreement looks like, is going to be have a significant amount of impact in terms of other foreign actors, including Australia, being willing to invest long term there. Probably two parts to this question. First of all, do you think that Washington will be able to come up with some negotiated solution which will allow them to have some kind of military footprint long term? And B, do you think that would make a difference in terms of keeping the international community's focus to whatever extent it will maintain it on Afghanistan.
So if we had a different president, and I don't mean a Democratic president, I just mean a traditional president, right? Someone who put national interests above his own personal interests, I would say yes. But look at the state of our institutions, right? We still have large numbers of deputy and assistant secretaries at state unfilled. We still have large numbers of vacancies at the Pentagon unfilled. Much of this negotiation took place without a Secretary of Defense. I mean, we are, let this sink in. We are trying to go to war with Iran without a sitting confirmed Secretary of Defense. I mean, that, to me, I'm speechless, right? Can you imagine being so long without a confirmed Secretary of Defense? It is unimaginable to me as an American. I literally am speechless at this reality. And look at what he's done to our intelligence services, right? He is now, I mean, he's replaced Dan Coats, a stalwart Republican who had quite a bit of experience as the head of our national intelligence apparatus, and he wants to put in place a fellow whose previous, requirements or his previous job experience, I think, was driving an ice cream truck around. I mean, but he is a loyalist to Trump, right? And so the whatever cherry picking of the intelligence community we thought happened under George W. to legitimize the war in Iraq is nothing compared to what this man is doing. So I have to say that all he cares about is being reelected. He doesn't care about the sacrifices that any of us have made. He cares about being reelected. And so I can't sit here and tell you that I feel confident that that's going to happen. If that were the case, right, there should have, before he tasked Zalmay Zalilzad, for those of you who know Dara, you got that joke. Before he tasks Zalilzad to begin this negotiation, don't you think that we should have had, after the Secretary of Defense resigned, that we should have held off those negotiations until we had a Secretary of Defense in place? I would have thought that. So I'm just at a loss. And anyone who tells you they're not at a loss are not being honest. Because every day as an American, we wake up to see what does the tweet state say? And then we wait for a week to see if the deep state has rolled it back. And every day I wake up hoping that there is a deep state.
On those negotiations, though, do you think that the long-term maintenance of a U.S. military footprint is essential to maintaining the stability of the Afghan state as we know it? Or do you think without that, there is little hope of the state remaining intact?
So the the Afghan National Security Forces, they have a big problem, right? They can't recruit to replace their losses. They do not have certain core competencies, like they don't have medical evacuation. They're not terribly good at air support of any variety, close or otherwise. So if you really care about the ability of the Afghans to continue fighting and to continue to take the losses, I find it really hard to believe that this will happen without a strong international backbone, and the Americans will have to be a part of that. Also, having this strong American military backbone is also what's going to keep the Congress compelled to keep writing those checks, right? So that's what I think should happen. But when it comes down to, can Trump go back on his campaign trail, to Jesus Stan and say, I got us out of Afghanistan. I think that is going to trump, literally, anything else. And I've seen it on too many issues, big and small, domestic and foreign, to have confidence that some larger set of values and principles will prevail over his desire to be reelected. I mean, look at what we're doing. Look at our tariff policy, right? We're taking a humongous hit. And what he's doing he's basically buying off the American farmer, right? He's literally giving on average the American farmer something to the order of $236,000 right? Because they're a core constituent, and they're the ones that are primarily being hit by these tariffs. I mean, this is called crony capitalism or something, right? So unless he can have, I can't even imagine what would be the alternative to buying off those farmers. What's the alternative in this Afghan space where he prosecutes a policy to get himself reelected, but then secretly buys off the people that that are affected by it directly? I can't think of what it would be.
Listen, we've probably now got time for about 15 minutes of questions from the floor. Richard, and then one down here.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks very much for your presentation. My name is Jeremy from Macquarie University here in Sydney. I was just wondering if you thought that the sort of the overwhelming sort of Defence Department in America, their overwhelming role and power and investment in Afghanistan has, sort of instead of the State Department really being sort of driving the Afghan sort of adventure. Do you think that's played an important part or a major part in sort of the lack of success in Afghanistan?
So part of me rejects the premise, actually. We had at one point something like 6 ambassadors at the same time. I don't know what the number of ambassadors is in the embassy because I avoid going to the embassy like plague. Not because it's not useful. It's just that getting there is just such a pain, right? So I think it's a little bit of a different issue. The diplomats have a lot of difficulty getting out, right? And they expect everyone to come in. Even the intel assets expect their operator, their assets to come and see them at Fortress America, right? The military has always had a different advantage in the sense that because they're a military, they're forward deployed, right? Both State Department and DOD, they've had different problems. So let's look at, for example, the way in which we deploy soldiers, right? So depending upon the service, so the deployment varies, by the way, depending on what branch of service you're in, whether you're active duty, whether you're Guard, Air Force, Navy, Army, Marines, right? So some people we deployed for 6 months, some people are deployed for a year. And when they if they do get rotated back out for another tour, they will not frequently be back where they served, right? So you're constantly losing this expertise. You have the same problem with the State Department because obviously it's a non-family post, the tours are of various lengths, and you get a very wide array of quality. And when you have a non-family post for so long, let's just say we don't always get our A-team. So I would say the problem is a little bit different. You have these different agencies, and they have these very different deployment mechanisms, and we have a terrible history of sort of remembering what we already did. Now, this is going to sound a little bit counterintuitive, but back in the day when you had cables and all of your institutional memory was kept in cables, there was this repository where you could go and learn. We tried to do this. This was the result. Well, now people try to avoid putting anything in cables. They pick up the phone, they send emails, right? It is very difficult to remember what did and didn't work. And so I've been watching this now for decades, but I'm amazed at how many bad ideas continue to repercolate. So I don't think it's a question of their number. I think it's a question of what they did and how they did it and where they did it.
Thank you. Richard McGregor from the Lowy Institute. I fall under the classification of non-expert. The Taliban is part of the negotiations which have taken place, are taking place. Can you tell us about the Taliban? Are they the same as they were previously? Are they independent? Or do they have an independent set of interests apart from Pakistan? Are they a single entity? And would they, as they did prior to 9/11, re-harbour Al-Qaeda or ISIS assets?
No, so that's a brilliant question. And the answer to all of those questions is yes, right? So you've got some Taliban that are from Taliban 1.0, but by virtue of math and biology and the battlefield, you also have new people that are brought to the table. So the answer is it's a pastiche. The Taliban is I prefer to use the Taliban is like, it's a catch-all term for a collective of different commanders, some of whom confederate together in one point in time and some of whom don't. So like the Haqqani network, for example, not really part of the Taliban. Sometimes they operated with, sometimes they oppose them. The Pakistan puzzle is an interesting one, right? Because many Taliban hate the Pakistanis as much as they hate us, right? Because they understand that the Pakistanis are only interested in them instrumentally. And so that's why, for example, you'll see the Taliban. Why did the Taliban want to be in Doha, right? As opposed to like Kuwait, right? Or excuse me, as opposed to Dubai. Because the Pakistanis didn't have a large presence in Doha. It gave them some insulation from the Pakistanis. You'll see, you know, the Taliban have made efforts to reach out to Iran, to Russia. You know, the Taliban don't want to be solely dependent upon Pakistan. But the reality is they still very much are. So I go to Afghanistan like once a year, sometimes twice a year. And we go to this thing called the Herat Security Dialogue, which is nice because the Taliban will usually have some shadow representative there. And they're pretty clear about what their demands are. They don't want to have to contest elections. They want to have power without it. They don't want elections at all. And they want to reverse women's rights, right? And so the Americans, you have to understand, is you do. You mostly interact with people closer to your own age, right? We all do, right? When I was 14, I wasn't hanging out with 40-year-olds. When I was 40, I wasn't hanging out with 20-year-olds. Now that I'm 50, I don't hang out with anyone because I become an old grouchy lady. However, the Americans are interacting with Afghan interlocutors who are their own age, right? And failing to understand the Afghan pyramid, which is really has a very large young base, they're mistaking, well, yeah, you know, the 60-year-olds are happy getting rid of elections. They, you know, the elections, they're fraudulent anyways. Who cares? And if you mistake the views of your contemporary interlocutors as the views for the rest of this country, you are making a very big mistake. But the Americans seem to think, based upon the people they interact with, that Afghans are completely fine with getting rid of elections. So I fear, again, going back to the overarching drive of Trump to make this happen, that we're going to find a way of throwing the Afghans under the bus, putting the bus in reverse, and driving over them a couple of times, if that's what it takes to get Trump reelected. That's what we're going to do.
Hi, I'm Leanne Smith from the Whitlam Institute.
And my former colleague at UNAMA.
And a former colleague. Chris, it's so great that you're in Australia talking about these things, even though it's hard to hear, I think, for a lot of people. You and I met at a time when there was a lot more optimism about what was going to happen in Afghanistan, and both of you today have mentioned the kind of the separate objectives, the counterterrorism objectives and the regional issues, and then economic incentives for a stable Afghanistan. But in 2007 and 8, we were also using the language, which is now a dirty word, I suppose, of nation building, like the idea that we could help a failed state recreate itself as a nation that would have it be able to generate its own stability and unity going forward. And I don't hear anyone talking about that anymore. But what we do know is that we built the expectations of a generation of Afghans around the things we said we were going into Afghanistan to do. And for me, the disconnect between why we were really there and why we are still really there and what we said we were there to do has left a generation of Afghans with raised expectations, some more education, some more exposure, and I worry about what's going to happen to them as this all unravels when these peace negotiations have no room for many of them, including the women. My question to you, Chris, is...
Well, by the way, you know I agree with you 100%. When I talk about rentier state, I'm actually talking about that state-building project, right? Because we never built self-sustainment in it, right? We built it.
Absolutely.
But there was never sustainment.
Absolutely. So I just wondered, if the writing's on the wall, if the US is pulling out, have you had many conversations with other international stakeholders? I'm thinking of the EU, I'm thinking of NATO partners, about what a US withdrawal means for them and for those who are still committed to anything like a nation-building agenda in Afghanistan?
So, to be honest, no one uses that language anymore. it just, I couldn't tell you the time when it disappeared, but it did. I would say it from what I've seen, the last I heard of it, the last hurrah was, and if this might be a little bit inside baseball, remember the government in a box. This was a lovely thing that Obama came up with, going to the State Department question. And I remember just laughing my arse off because I was like, you have got to be kidding me. This was around Operation, this was like the absurdity, one of the highlights of the American carnival in Afghanistan. The Marines were going to go into Helmand, and because they're the Marines, they have to have a separate AOR. So you had these different regional commands in Afghanistan. So RC South, which was, as you might imagine, the South. It included Kandahar as well as Helmand. No, that's not good enough for the Marines. They have to have their own regional command. So we broke it up. We had RC East, RC Southeast, we had RC Southwest. RC Southwest was going to be the sandbox of the Marines. And if you were watching TV on Valentine's Day 2009, it was Operation Moshtarak. The first Mew, or was it the second Mew? I can't keep track of the Mews. They were going to go in, and they were going to secure a particular part of Helmand, which, by the way, had no strategic significance whatsoever except for making good CNN footage. And after it was secured, they were going to drop in a government in a box. What is a government in a box? Well, it's a governor and representatives of the line ministry. Now, do you think that the parachuted in government in a box was efficacious? No, it wasn't, in case you're wondering. The governor in a box, he was actually plucked out of Germany where he had just shot and murdered his own son. Apparently, that was the qualifications for being this particular governor in a box. So that... And it was amazing to me, you know, after all the congressional hearings, and it came out of McChrystal's interim report that was also leaked to put pressure on Obama to stay in Afghanistan against his own better instincts to not stay. All those people that gave testimonies before Congress assuring us that the surge is going to work, the government in a box is going to work, they've never been held to account. Congress has never summoned them and said, hey, Seth Jones, you said X, didn't happen. Why are you now telling us what to do in Syria? Right? But that's the brilliance of this business, is that you can provide all sorts of failed burnout advice in Theater A, and people will forget that because you've already recreated yourself as an expert in Theater B. So that's the last time I ever heard anything about state building, was the magnificent failure of the government in a box, which I think was a great T-shirt. Can you imagine, like, little Jack in the Box, anyways, with the murderous governor escaping murder charges of his own son in Germany? Happy days.
Good afternoon. Thank you for talking to us today. In the past, Pakistan has used Kashmir as a bargaining chip to get the Taliban, or use their influence over the Taliban to get them to the table to discuss with the Americans. How do you see the recent developments in Kashmir and their impact on the negotiations with Taliban?
The Pakistanis have never actually done that. I can't agree with the premise of the question. There have been some historically uninformed Americans who should have known better, who have put such a preposterous grand bargain on the table. But the Pakistanis themselves never have, until Imran Khan. Right, Imran Khan. I mean, his the boys in Ampara, which is where Pakistan intelligence hangs out, they must be absolutely thrilled, because as a sitting prime minister in Washington D.C. with President Trump, he was actually able to link those two. Usually, it's been the Americans. Like, for example, Ambassador Holbrooke. He's an example of someone who linked those two. Dalrymple is someone who links those two. Anyone who's linking these things has a really bad understanding of history, right? Because it assumes that Pakistan's apprehensions about Afghanistan reduce to India, and they don't. The Afghans do a lot of things that are incredibly antagonizing and ill-advised towards Pakistan. The Afghans, when it comes to Pakistan, are their own worst enemy. The Indians, of course, have layered on to that. But this is not the only reason why Pakistan has problems with Afghanistan. I would say the biggest issue that Pakistan has with Afghanistan is Afghanistan's refusal to recognize the Durand Line, its historic intervention in Pashtun territories, and its support for Baloch insurgents. And India has nothing to do with those policies. Those policies stem from Afghans' own beliefs about the region, partition, and the agreements that were foisted upon them in the late 19th century.
We've got what time for one more question.
Thank you very much. Milton Osborne, no identification, no affiliation these days. I read Steve Cole's Directorate S in preparation for your very interesting talk, for which I thank you. And I'm even more depressed than I was after reading the book. If you were to place yourself in the position of the Taliban in current negotiations, why would you give away anything?
I wouldn't. I'm winning, right? I'm winning. I wouldn't give away anything. That's why they're continuing to fight, is to demonstrate that they are winning. So, as I said, this is a loss. They and their Pakistani handlers know that they have what Trump wants, right? They're going to get is pretty much what they want out of this, because if Trump wants to win and he thinks winning means getting out of Afghanistan, he's going to hand them the keys. And to Leanne's point, there are a lot of Afghans who deserve better. In fact, the 99% of the country that are not a part of the Taliban project deserve better. We're throwing them to the wolves so that Trump can be reelected. And it's very hard to as my mother would say, because I'm from a rural part of Indiana, we may put chocolate on a turd. It is not a donut.
Well, I suppose it's going to have to leave it on a down note, I'm afraid. But when conversation goes to Afghanistan, too often, unfortunately, things do end on a sour note. But I'd just like to thank everybody here today for coming, and I would ask everybody here today just to help me to thank Christine for a very forthright, honest, and experienced word. I'm sure Christine will be happy to stay around for a couple of minutes after this if people want to ask one-on-one questions, or people in the audience who know Christine and want to say hi, feel free to come up and engage in conversation. And just the last word for the next two events this Thursday evening here, a panel discussion entitled Hong Kong on the Brink, about the current situation in Hong Kong and what it may hold for the future. And next Monday, this very same location, in a panel discussion on maximum pressure, making sense of President Trump's Iran policy, we'll have a US policy expert and, strange enough, two actual Iranians to talk about an Iranian perspective on the Trump policy.
Who are they, by the way?
Two academics from Australia. So that should be a fascinating panel discussion. Get both sides of the coin on that, and that'll be here next Monday at the same time as we have been today. So thanks very much, everybody, and hopefully see you next Thursday and next Monday. Thank you.